Good afternoon, everyone. Sorry for the slightly late start here. It's great to see so many folks in the room. I'm really happy to see all the interest in this, and I hope that there are some more chairs. I know it looks to me like we might have a few more people than chairs. So, okay. Oh, we got a whole row in the back over here. So if you need a chair, please come on over. So I am really delighted to be here in Rochester today and to have to be joined by so many members of the legislature. Not everyone here is actually on the HHS Finance Division, but I think it's wonderful to have members who sit on various HHS committees, and I don't know if there's anyone here who doesn't sit on any of them, but we're delighted to have all of the members here today to talk about prescription drugs. And we are going to have a couple of what I think are going to be really wonderful presentations. So we're going to start right in and start with Dr. Vincent Raj Kumar, who's going to talk to us about, he's a Mayo Clinic physician. I think he could maybe give us just a bit of introduction about himself and give us his presentation. And then we will have some time for questions. I think that members may have some questions, and I hope to be able to have some time to entertain those, because I think asking questions might be a really good way to understand this better, because this is a very complicated topic. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and representatives, it's a real honor to be here to be able to talk on a topic that I'm very passionate about, which is prescription drug pricing. And I would request the chair if I can show some slides and talk from the podium.
Please, absolutely.
I must say that these are, I work at the Mayo Clinic. I'm a hematologist. I've been at the Mayo Clinic for over 25 years almost. And what I'm speaking is my personal opinion doesn't necessarily reflect the opinions of the Mayo Clinic. Now, I'm not an economist. I'm a cancer doctor, but I have worked very closely with pharmaceutical companies in designing clinical trials for them, phase one, phase two, and phase three. I led the trial that led to the approval of thalidomide in the United States for the cancer called multiple myeloma. And you can see here multiple regulatory trials with new drugs. So at least I know how the game is played. At the same time, I must confess, I still work with pharma. I am not an enemy of pharma. I just want to state that very clearly, that the problem is not just pharma, but the whole system. And so we have to understand what the problem is. My talk is really going to be in two parts. The first part is just describe the magnitude of the problem we are facing with regards to prescription drug prices. And secondly, go into details about why is this happening. I told you I'm a myeloma doctor. Myeloma is a cancer of blood, bone marrow cells, which affects about 1%. It accounts for only 1% of all cancers, but affects about 30,000 Americans each year. Almost all of these people eventually die of the disease. There have been a number of developments over the last 10 years, but the problem is that treating myeloma is extraordinarily expensive. As you can see here, it costs $22 billion to treat only the patients who were diagnosed in 2017, and that's just for the prescription drugs. It doesn't include hospital costs, diagnostic tests, and so on. And the reason for that is every single myeloma drug is expensive. Many drugs cost $100,000, $200,000 a year. And we don't use these drugs by themselves. We use them in combinations of three and four drugs. So you can see that the annual cost of treating a myeloma patient can be $250,000, $300,000, and now with four drugs, even $500,000 a year. These patients, thanks to the advances in treatment, now live for many years. And myelomas have become a chronic disease. So this is not just a 1 year and done cost. It's year after year, you're spending $100,000 or more on the care of these patients. I think I am in the top 1% of income earners in the United States, being a Mayo physician. But if there's one thing that scares me when I'm retired is what will happen if I get a cancer and have to take a prescription drug. And the reason is that in the old days, most of the money that was spent on prescription drugs came in the form of copays. That is a fraction, that is $10, whatever the cost of the pill is, you pay that and you get your monthly drug. Over the years, it has changed to the point where a lot of it is deductible, which is a problem for families earning low income because you have to pay it all in 1 month. But more importantly, for people like me, it is coinsurance, which is a percentage of the cost of the drug. So as the drugs become $20,000 a month, even 10% of the cost of the drug becomes prohibitively expensive. This is not just happening in myeloma. It is happening in every single cancer. You can see here, every cancer has new drugs. Every new drug is expensive. In fact, in 2017, every new drug approved by the FDA costs more than $100,000 a year. And some are now testing the limits of whether they can go up to $300,000 a year or $400,000 a year. The United States spends about $340 billion on prescription drugs, which is 10% of the overall healthcare spend. Of this $340 billion, about $130 billion are from Medicare, and that's $30 billion in Part B and $100 billion in Part D. Another $10 billion for Medicare and another $10 billion for VA, and we spend like half of the amount from the government resources. The rest are from private health insurance. Cancer alone accounts for $50 billion of the spend. But we spend more than any other country. The per capita spend per person one year is $1,025 now. And that's far more than Germany or Switzerland's spend, which is shown in the next two curves, more like $600, $700. And if you look at the other developed countries, these are not developing countries, other developed countries, they spend far less. And the reason is that not just cancer drugs, but just about every prescription drug is far more expensive in the US than in any other country, as you can see here. And this starts with Lantus insulin to Cresto, the lipid-lowering drug, to Humira, to Sovaldi. We are the highest prices. If you ask pharmaceutical companies, they'll give you four big reasons why prices are so high. Number one, it takes a lot to develop a drug, like $1 billion or two. The drugs that they are approving are very valuable. They save lives and therefore they're worth it. And number three, that market forces will decide and that we should just not interfere with the free market. Number four, any attempts to regulate prices will just dampen innovation and then you won't get your drug. The problem is all of these four arguments are actually not quite true. It does not, independent analysis shows that it doesn't cost $1 billion to develop a drug. The many, many of the cancer drugs that are approved don't work for like a year or two, but they hardly work for a month or two, but yet they are priced at $100,000. And there are no free market forces. It's not like the automobile industry or the telephone industry. There is only a monopoly and there is no barrier to importation, a barrier to competition. So it's not really a free market. And really, if we think about it, if you can make money with, if a drug works for a week, I can still sell it for $100,000. Why innovate when you can just make a me-too drug, a slight modification of your previous drug, and then sell it as a new drug that improves life? And now you've got, if we don't reward like the more benefit, the more money, there is a problem. Still, all of those arguments pharma can fight with me about, but they cannot fight this one. You can justify the high price at launch, but you cannot justify the price increase year after year of the same drug. That cannot be done. It's not like an improvement of that drug. It is like Apple selling the same old iPhone for 10 times the price now. And you can see here, every targeted drug on this list has gone up in price year after year after year. And I actually did a Twitter request asking people to just tell me outrageous price increases that they have witnessed. And I got a flood. I mean, two, three pages of this kind of list where old drugs, not new drugs, old drugs prices have increased by 1,000%, 10,000%, 5,000%, and some of them overnight. If you look at this slide, you will see there are three big types of prescription drugs we are talking about. One is the generics. The generics account for like 80% of the prescriptions. However, they bring in only a small percentage of the revenue, like 20%. And those prices have not gone up. In fact, they have fallen. You can see generic prices in 2012 592 has gone down to 365. This is a basket of generic drugs. This is the average price of generic drugs has actually dropped. Especially on the other hand, brand name drugs have almost tripled and doubled in price. You can see there 3,500 gone up to 6,700. This for the same kind of drugs, the same drugs often. And then specialty drugs, average specialty drug. This is the drug that people take for cancer or Humira or a monoclonal antibody. Those used to cost about 25,000 in 2006. They cost about 46,000 in 2012, and now they cost $78,000 per year. Which brings us to insulin. Insulin is the one Achilles heel of pharmaceutical industry because they cannot justify the price increase. It used to be $25 a vial for the same Lantus, that's now close to $300. And the problem with insulin is that 1.3 million Americans have type 1 diabetes. This is not the type of diabetes people get by not eating well or becoming overweight. This is something that they're born with. They cannot prevent it. And unfortunately, without insulin, they will die. So the second part is, why is this happening? Why are prices so high? Why are prices continuing to increase without any reason? And what are the factors at play? And I'll go through some of these. These are very complex because unless there are multiple factors at play, and unless we look at the whole totality, tackling just one problem is not going to help. Number one, circumstances. In many situations like cancer, type 1 diabetes, we are dealing with a vulnerable population. They don't have a choice. Having a prescription drug that saves their life is not something like I can live without my Toyota Camry or Lexus. They have to have it, and pharma knows it. Therefore, they can price it at any level they want. And there is no law that prevents it from pricing it at $100,000, $1 million a year, because there is no law that prevents it. In fact, you've heard of gene therapy that was priced at $2 million. Number two, it's a monopoly. For many, many drugs, there's only one drug, and you have to either take it or there is no other alternative. And even in a cancer like my, the field that I work with, multiple myeloma, where there have been a number of FDA approved drugs, the cancer is incurable. Most cancers are. And therefore, having five drugs doesn't give me any peace of mind, because eventually every drug fails and patients have to go through every drug. So it is each drug represents a monopoly, and pharma knows that you will come to their drug eventually. Patent evergreening. This is the art of taking a drug and make the patent last 100 years. Insulin is a great example to look at this, because it's baffling how a drug made 100 years ago can be priced so high still and still have so many patents left. And that's because you can make tiny improvements and patent that over and over again. So insulin was discovered in 1923. The first patent was in 1923. And then you have 1946, they had an improved version of insulin called NPH, which lasted longer. That was patented. And then the Lente insulin, which was a little bit more predictable, longer action. And that was patented in the 50s. And then in 1970s, there were more purified insulins that were developed. Those were patented. By 1980s, there was recombinant insulin, that is human insulin, that was made. And that was patented. By the 1990s, you had analog insulin, which is even better than the insulin that our body makes, because it's particularly when you take it as a diabetic, it's very predictable in its action for a duration of time. So those were patented. And by 2000s, you had long-acting insulin, particularly Lantus, Levemir, that were patented. These are like one dose a day, and you have very predictable blood sugar control, analog insulin. But Lantus, for example, has patent life for another 37 years. Because it has another 64 patents that they've had on it. You can patent the same drug. And this type of patent evergreening goes on with many drugs, including the ones that I work with, like lenalidomide. And then planned obsolescence, where this is a very strategic move where you go after both physicians and patients and tell them that the old drug is no longer great. So for example, this advertisement was from 1984. It's for insulin, when the human insulin first came. It was reprinted in the New England Journal of Medicine, where they've got a small child injecting himself with insulin and saying, this kid is already living in the past. He should really be using the new insulin. What is he using the old insulin for? And so the same thing happens over and over again with many drugs, like here, imatinib, Gleevec, one of the greatest success stories of leukemia therapy. Once imatinib's patent was dying and it's starting to become generic, doctors were convinced that imatinib is not really a great drug. You should really be using nilotinib, which is the better drug. It's far more, far less side effects and far more effective, and so on. So that patent evergreening and planned obsolescence are important things. We also have barriers to generic entry. It's not very easy for generic companies to come here and sell drugs. We have barriers from the FDA. We have barriers in the form of lawsuits, where the moment a generic company wants to come in, there is a patent fight from the brand name innovator. And then finally, there's clear cases of pay for delay, where the companies pay the generic companies not to come in for a specified duration of time. Lockstep pricing is very hard to describe because it almost is like tacit collusion, where the price goes up lockstep. I haven't seen that with any other product. Sometimes prices go up, sometimes prices go down. But two drugs made by two manufacturers going up every day by the same amount is not, I haven't come across these kind of graphs before. But these are insulin, and there are indeed two lines with each one. I mean, one is Levemir and Lantus, and the other one is Humalog and Novolog. Every time the price of one goes up, the other goes up the same amount, sometimes the same day or the same week. And that means that the system itself is at fault, which allows this kind of thing to happen, where there is no benefit in lowering the price and capturing market share, which would happen in any other industry. But rather, unless you increase the price automatically, you're going to be at a loss. So I'm not blaming pharma, but our middleman system is such that prices have to go up lockstep. Otherwise, it is going to be a problem for both companies. Now, this is something that was initially noted with Viagra and Cialis and Levitra when they came in, and was referred to in a book as erectile pricing. Middlemen. This is a very hard slide to describe, but just if you try to find out what is the price of a drug, you will drown, because there is net price, list price, wholesale acquisition price, negotiated price, and so on, and you won't even know which price they are talking about. The point to make is that there is a supply chain, and the supply chain has got the pharmaceutical company, the wholesaler, the pharmacy benefit manager, the insurer. Everybody gets a percentage of the cost of the drug, so it's in their best interest for the cost to be high. Except for the patient, everybody benefits from a high price. There are also three specific reasons unique to the United States. Number one is Medicare has to buy and provide drugs for its beneficiaries, but it cannot negotiate directly for the price. And there is no regulatory agency. Most developed countries, there is another regulatory agency after approval, which negotiates the price based on value, but we don't have a secondary agency like that. There is a ban on personal importation, and there is a reimbursement system we have which rewards doctors who give the most expensive option with more dollars. So all of that contributes to the high prices. But things can change. Like, for example, here are two cholesterol-lowering drugs that were both priced, one by Amgen, one by Sanofi, both priced $14,000 a year when they came out. But the ICER, Institute for Clinical Economic Review, they said these drugs are really worth only $5,000. And both companies blinked, and Sanofi first lowered the price to $5,800, and Amgen followed suit. So if we have a secondary agency that can actually, that puts out a value statement on this is what the drugs are worth, companies may react favorably. One might ask, why are patients not up in arms over all of this? And how come we haven't had millions of patients out there talking to you and asking you, why don't you do? And there are patients asking, but it's not like a wave. Part of the reason is that patients are being silenced, because pharmaceutical companies want you to focus on out-of-pocket costs, not the cost of the whole system. The whole system is all the taxpayers, all the people who pay premiums for insurance. But if you focus only on out-of-pocket costs, then the patient can be happy and you've lost the voice of the patient. So for example, this is actually a tweet that a friend, a person who is known to me with multiple myeloma posted. He said, you know, my monthly medication cost for two pills that he takes. One is lenalidomide or Revlimid. The other is ixazomib or Ninlaro. Revlimid costs him $15,000 a month. Ninlaro costs him $10,000 a month. He takes it month after month, And you can imagine 25,000 month after month. He has a copay of $2,000 for each one. And what copay assistance programs do is basically pay that copay. So when they pay that copay, he doesn't have to worry about out-of-pocket costs. He can get the drug virtually for very, very small amount of dollars, like $50 or something. So then he doesn't have to protest on the streets, why is this lenalidomide so expensive? I will tell you, the problems, as I've outlined, the magnitude is big. The reasons are many. I wish I had the list of solutions to offer or what people should do both at the federal and state level. There are many, many solutions, and I'm sure that from what I've read in the newspapers, you're working very, very hard on it. One really great solution, which my colleague Eric Tiki is going to talk to you about, is basically nonprofit pharmaceutical companies, where we can manufacture drugs that are commonly used for a low price and then provide for our citizens. I'm sure you'll hear more on this from Eric. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rajkumar. First, I want to note for members that the presentation is in your packet. So I know that some of the slides are small, and they're even in the packet, some of the information is pretty small, but we do have it. So if you feel like you didn't get quite the chance you wanted to look at one of the slides, we've got it here. I think we could probably entertain a few questions before we move on. Are there any questions? And we do have a microphone if members want to ask something. Representative Hamilton, did you have a question?
Thank you. Madam Chair, what I wanted to hear is the possible solutions. And so would that be the next testifier?
Well, I think that we're going to hear about Civica, which is the slide that is up there. And so that is one solution, yes. And I know, Dr. Rajkumar, you said that you wish you had the list of solutions. Do you want to give us any thoughts? You don't have to, but if you have any thoughts about how to approach the solutions, indeed, this is the big question for all of us. What can we do about it? Please, if you have anything you want to say to that point.
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, thank you for asking me. Clearly, I have thought about solutions and I have written about it. I just don't know. I just want to be clear that whatever solutions that I propose are not ones that are necessarily the views of the Mayo Clinic, because I haven't had a chance to discuss with them. But besides nonprofit generic pharmacies, other things that can be done are Medicare negotiation, which is favored by 80 to 90% of the country. Having some kind of value-based pricing where the price of a drug is proportional to the value it provides, and some kind of legislation so that price increases are tied to inflation. If prices were tied to inflation, the specialty drug that cost $26,000 going up to $78,000 would have gone only from $26,000 to maybe $30,000. So things like that other states have done and can be entertained.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Rajkumar, my question for you is this. There are some people who are sitting around this table, in fact, who think that the fair price of anything is simply what you can get somebody to pay for it. That's it. Is that a fair way to approach the delivery of pharma? If not, why not?
Dr. Rajkumar? Maybe Madam it's a Chair. Little bit of a loaded question. I
don't yes,
know. Absolutely not, Madam Chair.
I don't know how to say, because this is a deep discussion that the country as a whole has to have in terms of, are we going to help each other out with payments, or is everybody going to have to pay whatever they can afford? I don't know how I can answer the question without, this is not personal opinion here.
Sure.
Fair enough, Madam Chair.
And I
get that, and I understand that, not wanting to put you on the spot. And I think your reluctance to be put on the spot, as well as the reluctance of a lot of people sitting around the table, demonstrates the power and authority and money that Big Pharma has in this country, and why it's gone on this long without a solution. So that's our job to think about here, and I appreciate your presentation, Doctor. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Schultz, and then Edelson, and then Morrison, and then I think we'll go on to the next presenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So getting to Representative Lesch's question, you know, we brought this up at the last committee hearing, talking about rationing by income or ability to pay, and, you know, some people around this table don't want to go that route. We want to make sure everybody has access to high-quality health care and prescription drugs. My question is about biosimilars. So I recently learned from some hospitals that they're having a difficult time negotiating directly with pharmaceutical companies for biosimilars, which are very expensive medicines. And there are insulins that are biosimilars because it's the health insurance company that will negotiate a discount and get that discount, get the value themselves, and require that providers use certain biosimilars. And therefore, they have to stock many biosimilars and don't get the discount directly. And so the health insurance companies may not be passing on that discount to patients. And in my district, it's $2 million per year. I think for mHealth, it's like $6 million per year that we're paying more because the health plans or health insurers are getting the discount. And we're not allowing the providers to negotiate directly and pass that on to patients. So can you speak at all to what's happening with the biosimilar market and what we could do? I have some ideas and I think I'll draft legislation, but what insight do you have for biosimilars?
Dr. Rajkumar.
Madam Chair and Representative, this is a great question. I'm not a great expert on this, but I think my colleague Eric might be able to address part of the question. But I think one aspect is clear, that biosimilars approved in the U.S. are just as good as the brand name products. And so physicians' reluctance to prescribe should not be a barrier. And that's an education thing, that we have to educate physicians that biosimilars made in the approved in the U.S. are just as good as the brand name innovator. Once that is known, for certain biosimilars like Neupogen and Neulasta, the uptake has been quite good. And many, many institutions have switched to the cheaper biosimilar than the brand name product. And in some institutions, the uptake is as high as 95% of their prescriptions are for the biosimilars. With the newer ones and with the insulin, things will evolve over time, I think. But I am not very familiar with how a hospital and or an insurance company deals with which product to keep higher on the formulary versus the biosimilar.
Okay, thank you very much. I misspoke before. It's Edelson and then Bierman, and then we'll go on to the next one. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, thank you for your perspective. I think you saying that this is a larger systemic problem, not just pharma, is really, there's so much truth to that. And we get very focused on talking about one specific thing. If we could just turn and talk to patients, about patients right now, though, just for a moment, in terms of the patients that you've cared for, we talk about these prices and how people are not able to afford these drugs. Have you personally witnessed this? And in all of your outreach, can you just give us, you know, an example of somebody that was not able to get the care they needed because of the cost without, of course, breaking any, you know, privacy?
Dr. Rajkumar.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative. I have, because I work in the myeloma field, a number of patients from around the country, even from around the world, check with me on, like, you know, what to do about their myeloma and the cost of their myeloma medications. More recently, because I've been involved with insulin, several people who have had problems of having access to insulin have also talk to me and describe their problems. And I've also reached out to people to find out what happened. And so this is a real thing. And if you look at the CASER health survey, the more number of medications patients take, the more difficult they find it to afford the drugs. Right now, I think 10% of Americans feel it very difficult to afford prescription drugs, and 30% say somewhat difficult. From another study, within 2 years of cancer diagnosis, people are having a problem financially with their families. So it is quite heartbreaking because, you know, one mother I spoke to who lost her child due to insulin, lack of insulin, I asked her, if you were here at this meet, at this talk that I was going to give, what would you tell physicians? And she said, well, tell your doctor's colleagues to talk to patients about affordability, because many times I think we are not telling patients about how much each medication costs and looking for whether or not the patient can actually afford it. And talking to the patient about affordability and helping them find a cheaper option or a better option that they can afford is something. And then the other thing that person told me to do is advocacy, which of course I'm doing in highlighting the problem.
Thank you very much. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Dr. Rajapikumar, for the presentation today. It's very enlightening, but also it's very familiar in a lot of ways. We kind of have addressed for a while the issues affecting drug prices, and it's some of it is starting to become a constant refrain, and we know that a lot of the solution may lie in the way things are done off our shores as far as price regulation. And I was just wondering, one of the things that people bring up is that if we try to control prices, regulate them in any way, shape, or form, that the pharmaceutical companies will then shut off the pipeline and we won't be able to get the drugs we need. And so that's one question. I'm wondering, in your experience, if you know of countries that have lost their access to any drugs whatsoever. And number two, I was interested more in you commenting about the launch price versus the price after launch, maybe 3 years, 5 years later, and how that price shouldn't be going up, it should be going down. So if you could comment on those two things, I'd appreciate it.
Dr. Rajkumar.
Madam Chair and Representative, thank you so much again for this great question. It is complex. First, I'll come to the launch price versus the brand name versus the price after thing. We have to just recognize that there is no law that sets a ceiling for either the launch price or the price increase that follows. And basically, both of them can be as high as the pharmaceutical company thinks the market will bear. And outrage is the only barrier or the only ceiling we have. In every other country, on the other hand, because they are buying and giving these drugs to their citizens, in effect, they are the purchaser, they have a ceiling. And that's a ceiling that the companies are welcome to go below. But they'll say that if your drug works for 1 year, we will give you $80,000 per year maximum. And then they negotiate around that amount, whereas we don't have a cap. And that allows these drugs to be elastic, the prices to keep going up, to try and see where the outrage, you know, starts. And then the continued year after year price increases, you know, was a very big problem that peaked in 2013, 2014. So 4% per year, the same drug price increase, went up to about 11, 12% per year in 2013 and 2014. At that time, it was the peak. But I think a lot of the voices that we have heard, where people have come forward and highlighted these price increases, has had an effect, to the point where the price increases are now, in the last 2 or 3 years, only about 4% per year, back to what it was in 2006. So I think there are some states which have tried to see if they can cap the price increases to a maximum allowed by the rate of inflation, which would be more like 2%. And that may help, you know, with some, both with out-of-pocket costs for patients as well as for the system. The first question, again, can you refresh me again? Yes. I have had a lot of experience with this because of the clinical trials that I've led. We must understand that some of the drugs that we have, the actual randomized controlled trial that led to the drug being approved in, by the FDA in the US, most of the patients were outside the US. So other countries' patients helped us get the access because they participated in the randomized trial in droves. When the drug is approved by the FDA, we get access almost immediately. Whereas in other countries, there is a delay of 2 or 3 or 4 years where they negotiate around the prices. So yes, if there is negotiation around prices, as long as the US is the one country where they can immediately set a price and get whatever the price they want, other countries do have a delay in getting that drug. As far as not getting the drug at all, there are one or two drugs that I know that are still not approved in some countries that we got approval years ago, and I think they're just still wrangling around what the price they can afford. Yeah. It is a problem, but I don't think that innovation will be affected, because if you think about it, for many cancers other than blood cancers, lung cancer, prostate, colon, pancreatic cancer, progress with each drug is only minimal, and most of the time it is a very similar drug to the previous drug that the companies try to develop, and that's because they can get a high price for that drug too. I think if we are not going to cap this is how much we'll ever pay you, but we are going to say we'll reward you more if your drug is truly innovative and prolongs life by 2 or 3 years, we'll give you even more money. That would make them truly innovate rather than now saying, like, why take the risk innovating and then the drug just fails in the phase 3 trial. I'll just take a Me Too drug and I can still get my $150,000 a year.
Right. And I think what Representative Bierman, I think, is going at here is we often hear sort of a threat from drug companies. If you don't let us do what we want, we'll just take our drugs and not sell them to you.
I don't believe that.
And that's, I think, more what he's getting at. Do you see that anywhere?
No, I don't believe that. Okay. We see that in every other product. I mean, there is not much money to be made in LED televisions, but they're just innovating every year to 16K and 32K till I can see every pore in the skin. So I think innovation will happen as long as there is a profit to be made.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Rajkumar. We really appreciate your being here today and giving us a wonderful presentation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Members, we're going to change up a little bit on the agenda here and bring in and have our presentation about Civica that is up there on the screen. And that is Eric Tishy. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. Maybe he'll correct me if I'm
currently an employee of Mayo Clinic. I work in supply chain for Mayo Clinic, and I'm responsible for the medication formulary, which is essentially a list of drugs that are covered within the Mayo Clinic health system. And we cover our entire enterprise. I think one of the interesting things about Mayo Clinic is that we own our own pharmacies that dispense to the community. We manage our own patients, and our own employees are also governed by our formulary. So Dr. Rajkumar and I are also beneficiaries of our own formulary and affected by the formulary decisions that are made by our organization. The innovation that I'm going to talk about today is Civica. So you heard a little bit about generic drugs and how the cost of those is so much lower than the cost of branded and specialty medications. And that truly has been one of the really great bright spots of healthcare in the United States is our competitive generic drug market. It's important to know that generic drugs didn't exist until about 35 years ago when the Hatch-Waxman Act was passed, which created the pathway for generic drugs to be available. And the generic drug pathway really applied to small molecules. So it's essentially simple chemicals that could very easily be replicated and they'd be identical. And so we have had such fierce competition in the generic market that a lot of the production of those products has moved overseas. China and India now are the largest producers of those, and that's one of the reasons why we have such low prices. One of the challenges, however, has been that the competition has been so fierce, sometimes it's been competed down to where there's just one maker of a product. And then when regulators go in and check some of these facilities, they uncover problems, and that could lead to inability to access medications. We then end up with severe shortages, that can be leading to increasing in prices or switching patients to more expensive therapies because there's never a shortage of the brand name product. So there's some headlines that you've seen before. These shortages, they do directly affect patient care. Sometimes we have to make decisions and truly ration products and decide one patient versus another is not going to receive the medication. And those are things that we don't like to have to do. There's some hidden costs there because we have clinicians that are very extensively trained and they're having to spend time thinking about these types of things, and we'd rather have them focusing on curing disease instead. Over the last 10 years, there's actually been about 200 drugs that have been on and off the drug shortage list. And most commonly, these shortage drugs are injectable medications that are given in the acute care hospital setting. So these are things that are used for anesthesia, antibiotics. We recently had a case where there was an essential component of a chemotherapy regimen that was not available. It became to absolutely zero was available. So we weren't able to use the ideal chemotherapy regimen for some of our patients. There's a number of different causes for this, and some of these are very different than what we see in the branded market. So the challenge here is actually unsustainably low prices that we experience at time. As I mentioned, there is the manufacturers of the pharmaceutical agents, and essentially what they do is they're putting raw materials into a bottle. And then there is the active pharmaceutical ingredient maker. We call that the API maker. And a lot of times there's 8 manufacturers and there's only one API maker. And a lot of times those API makers are overseas. And when there's a problem in the supply chain, it could be a natural disaster, it could be a regulatory issue, that becomes unavailable. Those lead to acute shortages. And then there are things where the pharmaceutical industry is very strategic. So if one manufacturer sees that, hey, there's only us and one other manufacturer left, if I buy out that manufacturer, maybe I have an arrangement with them so that they don't make product, then I have a monopoly and I can raise the prices to where they look like branded products. So for a number of years in health systems and in healthcare, we've been complaining about this. We've vented our concerns with legislators. We've directly complained to the pharmaceutical manufacturers. And in the last year, a number of organizations got together and said, all right, let's sort of pivot from this sort of victim mentality of saying we keep having these problems, and let's do something innovative. Let's get together. We think we have critical mass. Can we use a mechanism of the free market, which would be a not-for-profit status, and create a not-for-profit organization that would manufacture generic medications? And so that was how Civica Rx was established. It was started in September of 2018. They actually delivered their first drug today. So it was delivered in Utah, and it was used in a patient. So there's going to be some press around that. And you'll notice that Civica's number one policy is do what's in the best interest of the patients. And so if you work at Mayo Clinic, you'll know that that is part of the mantra of Mayo Clinic. And it gives you some understanding of the influence that the Mayo Clinic has had within the organization. So Mayo Clinic was one of the 7 founding members and is a governing member of Civica. So this is a nonprofit, non-stock organization, and it has a one price, transparent to all. And these are a list of the members, and you can see that Mayo Clinic's one of the founding members. Also, some of the governing members are a number of just nonprofit organizations that are trying to improve healthcare costs overall. So the disruptive approach here is a not-for-profit structure. The desire to have fair and sustainable prices, I think sustainability is an important piece of this. Having safety stock. So one of the things that we do in supply chain is we try to sort of not have a lot of excess in the supply chain. The downside of that is when you run into a shortage of supply, then you experience price hikes. So Civica is intentionally building in some safety stocks to help mitigate against those challenges. We are engaging in long-term contracts so that we can provide some certainty to the manufacturers that there will be demand for their product. We're also, Civica is the only pharmaceutical product that actually lists the source country of where the product is being manufactured. And Civica is preferring that product be manufactured in North America or the EU, where the regulations are a little bit more rigorous and the supply is a little bit safer. And so this is the commitment that Civica has made. It has kind of a three-pronged approach. So right now what Civica is doing is entering in those long-term commitments with manufacturers. Long-term, Civica is looking into building its own manufacturing facilities. And in the meantime, there are contract manufacturing organizations that we can work with where we can acquire the rights to produce a drug and then hire a facility to do the manufacturing so that we don't have to commit that great amount financially. So the role of Civica here is to sort of bring that competition into the drug market. I think one of the bright spots here, again, in healthcare, the generic market is an example of where we have seen competition truly bring down prices. And we want to bring some predictability to the market and mitigate against some of those abusive behaviors. So specifically at Mayo Clinic, this was an initiative that Mayo Clinic was quick to become part of. Civica has announced 17 generic medications that they will have available within the next two business quarters. And vancomycin is the first one that I had mentioned that has become available. It's an essential antibiotic that's commonly used in healthcare settings to treat MRSA specifically. And we've experienced shortages of vancomycin for about 10 years. So when I had told our purchasing director that vancomycin was one of the medications that we were committing to, she was very excited because it was something that, you know, we hadn't seen relief of that issue in such a long period of time. Mayo Clinic is specifically committing 10% of our 50% of our enterprise-wide purchases to Civica products. So the reason why we committed 50% is that we don't want to sort of remove other players in the market. And so we want to make sure that that competition is made. And this is not necessarily a overt cost-saving opportunity for the Mayo Clinic. So we're not necessarily going to get cheaper generic drugs through this process. What it will do is it'll protect us from these price spikes that we see when drugs become unavailable. It'll ensure that we're allowed to keep patients on the lowest cost and most effective product. We're dealing with a shortage right now of a drug called tacrolimus, which is a cornerstone of preventing rejection in organ transplant recipients. Because that drug is not available, we are putting patients on a branded drug that's about 60 times more expensive. So that gives you an idea of where the cost savings occur in the system by ensuring a stable generic market. And I think one thing I would add is that what we hope biosimilars will do for those complex protein molecules is kind of what we have seen with the generic molecules. So with that, I'll take questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Tishy. I guess I just have a question. I don't see members on the list, but I have a question. I just want to clarify. So it sounds like these organizations are coming together, first of all, to use their market power to have an impact. Would you characterize it that way, or is that just my own flight of fantasy here?
So thank you, Madam Chair. That's a great assessment. Market power is a big piece of this. I think Dr. Raj Kumar did an excellent job of explaining some of the market power challenges that we see with the branded and specialty products. And that's exactly what we are doing here. Mayo Clinic, as big as it is, it doesn't have the market power to open its own generic manufacturing plants. However, when we can collaborate with 1,000 other hospitals, well, then we start to have enough scale to do that.
And then the other piece is, as I'm understanding it, at least right now, you're talking about injectable drugs. And I'm just wondering if there's, and maybe you can't answer this, but are there plans for expansion? I mean, is this something that is going to be able to start helping the consumer and the person who has to go and buy insulin, for example? I mean, does this hold promise for that? It still sounds to me like it's kind of limited to this very special group of drugs, shortages and injectables, not necessarily just going in there to bring down prices of other drugs.
So thank you, Madam Chair. The strategic reason for focusing on these specific medications is that those are medications that are used inside hospitals where we've had these specific challenges and where the drug shortages have been most severe and where there are not necessarily alternatives. We do have a drug selection committee that discusses these things internally, and that drug that I just mentioned, tacrolimus, is an oral medication. It's something that's widely used in the community. That is something that we are talking about within Civica. The members are talking about that as an option. So that could directly impact, I think what you're referring to as consumers is sort of the general person filling a prescription at a retail pharmacy. The things that we're using in hospitals still affect prices as well. And so that's why we have that focus. I think one of the exciting things about this type of a project is that if Civica is successful, then either Civica itself could expand or there could be other organizations that take a similar approach and do something in the different markets.
Okay. Question from Representative Robbins.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Dr. Tishy. I have two questions. First, this is so exciting. I'm delighted to hear about it, and I'm a big believer in the power of the market. So if you could just comment on why you chose a nonprofit structure versus just creating another generic company that could compete in this space. And secondly, one of the questions I'm struggling with on the committee is we are in serious discussions about deciding that we are going to allow insulin for free in a special session. And I'm very sympathetic to families that struggle with the cost of insulin, and it's been horrific in our state. But I'm concerned from a market perspective of we as a legislature picking one drug and saying, mandating this has to be available for free. And then what will be the next drug and what will be the next drug? And I have no medical background. I don't feel qualified to make those decisions. So do you have any comment on this sort of piecemeal approach, or are there other ways that we could consider doing something rather than just cherry picking certain drugs where we are hearing most from our constituents, which is a very real issue? Is there a better way to structure any attempts we would do at that? Thank you.
And just to be clear, the proposal that the legislature hopefully is going to consider is for people under a certain income threshold and is only emergency free. I mean, there's another proposal in the Senate, but nobody's proposing right now just free insulin for everybody. So
I'm clear. I'm just concerned about the cherry picking aspect of it. Thank you.
So, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Both these questions are really difficult to answer. I'll start with the second one on the insulin. I agree. This is one of the things that we struggle with as healthcare providers is how do we say, well, the person with diabetes is more important than the person with cancer than the person with mental health disease. So I think that's why we have elected representatives to make some of those difficult decisions. I agree with you that it is a difficult decision, and I agree that if you do something for people with diabetes, then the people with transplants will say the same thing. So it's a very complex issue, and I think it comes down to a personal opinion on a lot of that. And then the question of why did Civica choose a non-for-profit structure? Well, when you look at all the organizations that are part of it, we're all non-profit organizations. Well, except for I think HCA might be a for-profit hospital system that is part of Civica. I think the board of governors of these organizations, it's consistent with the values and those types of structures. And this is, again, a personal opinion. It might be a little bit unseemly if a bunch of for-profit, if a bunch of not-for-profit organizations created a for-profit organization or conglomerate. So, again, that's my conjecture, and I was not part of the decision of creating the governance structure of the organization.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Albright.
Mr. Tishy, thank you for the presentation, obviously you've, by virtue of shared goals with your other founding partners, found a business model that works to bring together the market power for generic drugs. I'm just wondering what you would see as governmental impediments to expanding that to other areas, whether they be brand or specialty drugs, not only just in the hospital setting, but broadening the scope. So what is it that government does that impedes the expansion of your business model across the country?
Or Mr. Tishy, or what impediments are there, if you would care to even broaden that?
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. I think regulatory impediments are a big challenge. So as you add more regulation, that just increases complexity, and that gets passed on in the system, and it creates an additional barrier to entry for organizations to get into the, for example, generic drug manufacturing process. I think, you know, to the aspect of what could be done to sort of improve costs, to me, the biosimilars issue is a huge opportunity for us to save costs. I think reducing barriers to switching between the innovator product and the biosimilar product is an important step that could be done. We have interchangeability with generic medications. Ideally, we'd have that with the biosimilar, so it makes it easier to switch in between. And then it is a huge challenge. Dr. Rajkumar mentioned the way that patents are extended. Even the thalidomide drug that Dr. Rajkumar mentioned that's used for multiple myeloma, that drug was actually invented in the 1960s and is still a branded product, and it's wildly expensive. So how is that drug still a branded product? That's how some of the biosimilars are. It's astounding the number of patents that are out there protecting these products, and that creates regulatory challenge because things get tied up in the courts for years and years. So, you know, those are some of the things that prevent competition from occurring, because there really should be a free market for those things. They're long past the time when you would expect the patent protection to expire. There's just other mechanisms that are used to prevent competition.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, well, Mr. Tishy, we certainly appreciate your presentation. I don't know how many members knew about Civica Rx. I mean, I just knew it existed. I didn't really know that much about it, but thank you. I think this is really helpful to us to, and we'll be watching to see and hope that it has a lot of success. So,
thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thank you very much. So members, we're going to move on now to a presentation from Peter Briquity from the Minnesota Department of Commerce. As members will remember, in the last legislative session, we passed a bipartisan bill to license pharmacy benefit managers for the first time. And Representative Mann carried that bill. She's here. But Mr. Briquity from the Department of Commerce is going to give us an update on what's going on with implementation of that. And Mr. Briquity, I mean, of course, we're very pressed for time, but if you could just, for the benefit of the public, who may not even know what pharmacy benefit managers are, because we all had a really quick learning, a really quick education on that in the last session. We call them PBMs all the time, but if you could just give a brief explanation of what that is as you start your presentation, I think it would be helpful.
Well, Madam Chair, for the record, Peter Briquity from the Commerce Department. And Madam Chair, I think if there was a brief explanation of what PBMs did, we probably wouldn't have passed this bill last year. At a very high level, PBMs are contracted or contract with health plans to help deliver pharmacy benefits and administration to their plan members. So they're widely in use, not just in Minnesota, but around the country. In Minnesota, PBMs that are currently operating are licensed currently as third-party administrators. Third-party administrator licenses allow you to do a variety of different things, including pharmacy benefit administration. So maybe I'll start there, and maybe as we kind of get into the activities of the department and implementing the new law, we may be able to flesh out a little bit more what's going on. So thank you again, Madam Chair, for the invitation. And the Commerce Department is hard at work implementing the passage of the new law. And I'd also like to echo your comments earlier in thanking Representative Mann for her work on the bill, not only for championing the project itself, but also being a great collaborator with the department on the details of how we would actually go about implementing it. This is a new area of regulation for the department to be responsible for. And so Representative Mann was very willing to work with us and work on the actual language of the bill so that we actually could move forward quickly, because it is a very aggressive timeline to get everything up and running and have all the businesses licensed by January 1st so they can continue to operate in the state of Minnesota. We are on track to do that, I'm happy to say, and I think it's helpful to think of the laws having three parts, and I'll speak to each one of them. So we have the licensing process, which needs to be up and running by January 1st. The PBMs are also responsible for complying with new requirements that were put into the law related to their business practices. And then beginning in June of next year, there's new reporting requirements for the PBMs, both to the state and to their clients. So on the licensing side, members should recall that licenses are going to be issued to PBMs for 1 year at a time with annual renewals. The annual fee for both initial licensure and renewals is $8,500. Commerce will be processing the applications and issuing the licenses. We worked with an existing agency vendor who helps us administer other electronic, other license types for which Commerce is responsible electronically. And fortunately, our existing licensing vendor also is used by the states of Wyoming and Pennsylvania to administer PBM licensure. So we were able to not reinvent the wheel and get a process up and running pretty quickly. We're also working with our colleagues at the Department of Health, who are over on the other side of the room where I was sitting as well, on the PBM network adequacy requirements that were put in place, which are also part of the licensing process. As members know, MDH administers network submissions, or excuse me, reviews network submissions for health insurers through an interagency agreement with Commerce. And so we were able to leverage that existing relationship and their expertise in that area on the PBM network requirements. Network materials were due to MDH in mid-September in order to allow their staff to have enough time to review those submissions before the end of the year. Commerce has been communicating with industry members about the licensure process since July, and in August, we reached out to third-party administrators currently licensed in the state to let them know what the initial set of information and instructions for licensing would be, and then Commerce and health staff hosted two technical webinars for PBM staff to discuss the actual mechanical processes of getting licensed. So process seems to be on track so far, knock on wood. We've actually received one full application, I was told by our staff this morning, thus far, so we expect several others, or many others beyond that, just that one that we've received to date. The second major part of the bill, as I mentioned, were the requirements, new requirements on how PBMs conduct their business in the state. And while, as I mentioned earlier, businesses that are currently operating as PBMs should have an existing third-party administrator license, the new law sets out numerous new requirements for how PBMs have to work with plan sponsors, the pharmacies, and patients. This is, as I said earlier, a new area of enforcement responsibility for Commerce, and so we are working on identifying the additional skill sets that we need on our staff to be able to timely respond to complaints that we may receive. And in talking with insurance department colleagues from around the country in states that have already implemented PBM licensure, this was one point that they encouraged us to take very seriously and wish that in retrospect they had spent more time thinking about what skills you need on your investigative team to be able to respond to complaints about PBM business practices, and also how they may interact with pharmacies, which are two entities that traditionally insurance regulators, which the Commerce Department is for the state of Minnesota, don't traditionally have a lot of activity or engagement with. We really appreciate that the legislature, not only for the bill as a whole, but particularly in this space, recognized that it was a new area of work for the department and provided some funding resources in the HHS budget to be able to do that work. The third major component of the bill is transparency reporting. So beginning June 1st of 2020 and annually thereafter, PBMs will have to report both to plan sponsors and to the department, containing a broad range of data elements. That process we're starting to work on now, how that will actually look, in what form, and how the submissions will actually then be sent to the department. The law has some very specific requirements about how the data that is reported is to be treated under the Data Practices Act, and Commerce is required to then post publicly on our website any data that's not otherwise non-public for public consumption. In the long term, the department is interested in feedback from any and all interested parties on that process, and I would say the work done to date has helped us identify some areas where we need some more probably specific details for the participants in the process, and both on the licensing side and then also on the processes governing how we'll do data collection and reporting and enforcement. And so to that end, on Monday, the department published a request for comments in the state register regarding the possibility of rulemaking, which the bill grants to the department the authority to do. And so the request for comments is not in notice of intent to adopt rules, but rather an invitation to interested parties and stakeholders to give us some feedback about what areas we should be thinking about doing rulemaking in. And if they have suggestions for details, we would be all ears on that. So I'd encourage folks to review the agency's request, which again was published on Monday in the State Register, and we would welcome their feedback in the process. So Madam Chair, I'll stop there and see if there are questions. Happy to answer any from members.
All right, well, I don't have anybody on the list yet, but I guess I would ask you, Mr. Brickwitty, you, and I hope this isn't, I didn't give you a heads up on this at all, but
Madam Chair, those are the best questions.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad you think so. So what is a member of the public likely to see different? Is there anything, because a lot of this is obviously happening behind the scenes, interaction with pharmacists, interaction with payers, et cetera. Is there anything that the public is likely to notice from the passage or from the agency's implementation? And if the answer is no, that's fine. I mean, it doesn't not mean that that's not necessarily how we're going to measure the legislation, but I'm just curious about whether there will be something that the public will notice.
Madam Chair, I think that there will be a number of things, and I would defer to the chief author as well on her thoughts as well. But I think in a couple of areas, specific to the licensure process, one of the reasons why as a public policy decision we license certain types of entities to do business in the state is to provide recourse to consumers in the event that something goes wrong. And so I think for the public, it creates a venue at the Commerce Department to file a complaint if they feel the law is being violated in some form or fashion. So I think that will be something that the public will be able to make available or avail themselves of. I would also say that, Madam Chair, that in the bill, there are a number of provisions related to how consumers interact with their pharmacists and how the contracting relationship between PBMs and pharmacies has or has not in the past inhibited or limited information that a pharmacist can provide to a patient at the pharmacy counter. And so there are a couple of different places where consumers may be able to access more information than they otherwise were able to receive previously. They may not have even known that they were being limited in some form or fashion. There are also some provisions in the bill that allow patients to synchronize receiving multiple medications at the same time. So I think there likely are a number of things where members of the public will likely get improved services or more information when they go to pick up prescriptions from pharmacies.
Great. Thank you very much. So I have Representative Munson, then Representative Hamilton. Representative Munson.
Thank you. And thank you for the update on the Pharmacy Benefit Manager Bill. This is an important piece of information because I think a lot of this data is really important for the Department of Commerce to get to understand what course of action may be necessary in the future. My question is about rebates. So I've been reading after our PBM legislation passed, reading about what other states are doing for regulating PBMs. And I noticed that many states are requiring that rebates at least for Medicaid dollars, go to the state as opposed to going to PBMs. And I was reading through our bill to understand how the rebates were changed. And can you give us an update on if rebates have changed in any way other than just documenting where they're going? And if you've talked to departments of commerce in other states to see how their changes on rebates have impacted the market and in the pricing.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have a definitive answer to your question right now. And part of the reason why is because at the moment we're not receiving the transparency report. We won't get an initial data set from PBMs until June 1st, too many J months, June 1st of next year. So I think we'll get information flow. I'm referring back to the language that there is a lot of the transparency report coming to the commissioner is dealing with rebates in some form or fashion. So I think we will have information that we will receive. I think there'll be some question about what we end up being able to do and how we're able to provide that information both to the public and to you as policymakers, upon which you can then make decisions about public policy choices that may be better informed through that data. I think We'll know more than we know today after we start getting this reporting. How that will inform our decision making, we'll have to wait and see.
All right, thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, I think I look to you. I would hope that we could have an informational hearing on this in the spring as well, so that we can hear back from the Commerce Department the information that we are all looking for when we were looking at passing this bill, and subsequently if there's anything in addition to what we pass that we should be pushing forward in the next legislative session. So thank you.
Right. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. You know, certainly, you know, we could certainly put it on our agenda to have another update from Mr. Brickwitty at that time. And, you know, and just to remind people too, when we pass legislation on anything, especially when it's something new to our state, you never expect it to be perfect right out of the box, right? We always have to come back, get some experience and tweak legislation. So I think it's a really great suggestion. Thank you. Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. You mentioned that you've received one application from a PBM, kind of a multi-pronged question with regard. Are you receiving a lot of questions from PBMs in terms of how to fulfill the application process? Was the application that you received complete? And what have you observed in just looking at that in terms of follow-on with the PBM as you go through the process of coordinating with them?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, just let me know if I've missed one of the steps. I don't know if the application was complete because I think we just got it in. It was just happened to be the first one. The application portal's only been open for a few days, so I would expect many others, but we just have received that one. I think it was a priority for the department to communicate very quickly with the industry. We know who the big players are, so we were able to reach out and meet individually with them shortly after session ended and into the summer to just talk about timing and structure and how it was going to work. There is a really tight timeline, particularly for our colleagues at the health department, to review all of the materials that come in relative to the networks. The network filings that come in for pharmacies have the potential to be actually significantly larger than the filings for health insurers, because pharmacy networks actually tend to be broader in scope, or there may be more of them in number than there are for any given filing from a health insurer. So there's just a lot of time need to be able to make sure that the sequence was built in enough time for the PBMs to actually file an application and for staff to be able to review them and for us to approve them by January 1st. Our goal, as I said earlier, is to make sure everyone who wants to be licensed is up and licensed by January 1st. I think we're on track to do that. And I think if there are issues that come up, we'll be able to communicate with the applicants pretty clearly. We have the advantage of many of the existing players holding third-party administrator licenses in Minnesota, so we know who they are. We know how to be in touch with them and talk either with, you know, higher management level, but also or with a staff level communication on specific issues related to the application if there's a technical issue that we need to work through.
Representative Albright.
So on a PBM, you're licensing to the formulary that they give you on a static basis, on an annualized basis, and correct me if I'm wrong, but does licensure require them to state the number or the disaggregated information about what is on their formulary? And if that changes during the year, do they need to inform you or not?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I think the answer is no to both of your questions. Neither one of those are requirements under the new law for licensure.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Brickwitty. We appreciate you coming down here to give us this update, and we will definitely stay in touch. And I'm sure also the Commerce Committee will stay in touch as this goes on, and Chair Halverson is shaking her head. So, members, we are running really short of time. The next thing on our agenda is to have several members come up and kind of just for benefit more for the public to just talk about some of the legislation that they put forward in this last legislative session. We can still do that. We're going to have to be really brief, though. And I guess what I'd like to do is have the members come up together. And I also wanted to point out for members, in your packet, Mr. Chun from House Research has put together a really good comprehensive list of legislation that was considered or that was put forward in the last session around prescription drugs. And he's got a really helpful, it's a very helpful table about what happened to each piece of legislation. So I think we had copies of that for the public as well. And so just want to point that out for you because it's quite a bit of helpful information that's right here in your packet. So with that, I'd like Representative Morrison, Lesh, Cantrell, and so was somebody else on here that's not on my, it fell off my copy. Those three? Okay. And so, you know, I'm sorry to kind of cut your part of the presentation short, members. We really appreciate your being here, especially Representative Lesh is not on the committee and made a special effort to be here and was carrying some important legislation around prescription drugs. So I wanted to just, and we still have public comment, which we are going to take, so we are going to run a little bit over. So I would like if you could each just describe your legislation for the committee or for the group and especially for the public that are here. And, you know, just make any brief comment that you'd like to make in terms of your plans for next session or whether you've learned anything today that fits in or doesn't fit in with what you're trying to do legislatively. That would be helpful. And then we'll hear from the public.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Kelly Morrison. My bill was House File 1246, the Prescription Drug Price Transparency Act. And I think what we've learned today is how important it is to figure out how we lower the price of prescription drugs and increase transparency as part of that process. So the idea of this bill was to ask the manufacturers of drugs to report why their prices were particularly high. So that's for new drugs, newly acquired drugs, and existing drugs who meet certain thresholds. So new drugs who come onto the market above a certain price and newly acquired drugs or existing drugs that increase over by a certain percentage over 12 and 24 months. So the manufacturers are asked to report to the Commissioner of Health different criteria as to why, explaining transparently why they came, how and why they came up with that price. So this bill made it through several committees, and both the House and the Senate has bipartisan authors in both the House and the Senate and a Republican author in the Senate, and it was lost in the conference committee negotiations. However, the funding for it was included, so we're very hopeful and plan to take it up again this coming session. There's a broad coalition of stakeholders who support this effort, and I think it's an important piece of peeling away the onion as we try to figure out why prescription drug pricing has gotten so out of control.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Lesh, you want to go next?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. And I thank you for your indulgence earlier when I asked the question. I forgot that I wasn't on the committee. Because we're in a different setting, so I might not have raised my hand, but thank you for letting me ask a question. So this bill is probably, I don't know, if you're scared of change in the system, you're probably going to, this is your big Halloween bill. The transparency bill carried by my colleague that was just mentioned is one way to go. This states clearly that I'll just lay it out there. It allows the Attorney General to enforce this law with civil sanctions and authorizes the Board of Pharmacy to take disciplinary actions against manufacturers that raise the price of a drug unconscionably. We passed through a lot of committees last year, so I won't go through everything that happened in each one of them. However, it did pass through every single one of those committees. And I think that with what has happened since this past session, with people dying from lack of access to the drugs that they need, whether it be insulin or something else, I think that there isn't going to continually be an additional need for this next session, but it states that if your drug is essential, meaning you got to have it, it's like water to you or oxygen, and the folks that sell it to you know that you are the perfect consumer because you got to have it and you'll pay anything you can or you will die, then the Attorney General has the right to come in and prohibit you from charging that unconscionable price. And it's a little difficult when you hear that to think, wow, how could I allow a behavior like this to continue as a policymaker? And that's something, I think, question that we each need to answer ourselves. So I don't know if you're going to have a stand for questions, Madam Chair, on this because our time is short, but there's probably a lot of questions that some people would have about this. A lot of them have been raised in committees as well. But I feel confident of our progress in the House next session again of how we'll proceed. And I think the question as to how we'll fare really comes down to how many more people we are willing to let die until we pass this. And that is not hyperbole. That's happening now, and it will continue to happen. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesch. Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. So this past legislative session, I carried House File 1523, which is a bill that would direct the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services to establish a bulk purchasing program for pharmaceuticals. And the folks who would be eligible to benefit from this bulk purchasing, as it were, of pharmaceuticals would be folks who are currently on the managed care portion of our medical assistance services and folks who currently are on Minnesota Care. So the way that the system is structured right now is that people who are on are part of the fee-for-service medical assistance population, their pharmacy benefits are already being administered by the state. But for folks who are on the managed care portion of our medical assistance benefit and folks who are on Minnesota Care, their pharmacy benefits are handled through a third-party pharmacy benefit manager from their managed care organizations. So why is this essential? Why is this necessary? I would like to kind of outline that through through allegory by looking at, it was West Virginia, I believe, passed a bill similar to this, where they removed the pharmacy benefit managers from the administration of their public health programs. They assessed an estimated cost of $20 million, but ended up realizing an annual pharmacy savings or annual savings in the administration of their pharmacy benefit of about $28 million. So that kind of outlines the ability of state governments, particularly something that I think that can be replicated in Minnesota, to leverage the bulk purchasing power of ultimately what would be about 1.4, 1.5 million Minnesotans currently enrolled in our public programs to overall reduce the cost of pharmaceuticals. Currently, the 340B drug program provides pharmaceuticals at significantly reduced cost for eligible entities, and DHS is able to, or currently realizes about a 40% cost savings as a result of that. So kind of moving forward, it's I would be more than happy to discuss the fiscal note with anybody who is curious, because it is kind of a lengthy conversation around, well, the shifting of the current withhold that we pay to administer our pharmacy benefits through managed care. But ultimately, this will save not only the people enrolled in our public programs money, but also for health programs for HMOs who offer plans who want to contract with the state to benefit from this program. That'll be an option so that people even outside of the administration of our public programs are able to realize significant pharmacy savings should this become law.
Thank you, Representative Cantrell. And I don't know if you were already familiar with the Civica RX program that we heard about earlier, but I think it is pretty striking. That's a way of using the market power of these organizations together. And what you're talking about is using the state's market power on behalf of consumers to try to drive down prices. And if some of us are uncomfortable mandating stuff and doing the kinds of things that Representative Lesch and even Representative Morrison are talking about, you know, telling people you can't charge X, then what is the answer? And I think the other option in our, perhaps in our toolbox, where obviously we are very limited in some respects, is to use our market power. So I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you all very much for your presentation. I wish we had more time, but we're going to have to move on here. I know we had one testifier signed up, and that is Deborah Kiveni. Please come forward. So we're going to do the public testimony portion of our hearing, and you are a little bit over time, so we are going to ask you to be brief, but I know that you traveled a ways to be here with us today, and we appreciate that. So please just give us your name and go ahead and give us your testimony. If you can make it just a few minutes, that would be helpful. Thank you,
Madam Chair and members. My name is Deborah Kiveni. I'm a pharmacist, and I own a drugstore in Winsted, Minnesota. One of my previous jobs, though, was to also work as a pharmacy benefit manager, so I understand that industry intimately. And while it would be easy to throw big pharma and manufacturers under the bus, there's a second part to this whole problem with pricing, and that is the pharmacy benefit managers. We talk a lot about rebates. Rebates are there because the manufacturers need to get their drug on the formularies, because if their drug is not on the formulary and their competitor is, PBMs will move market share to that manufacturer. So they are incented to pay large rebates in order to get place on the formularies. What we found out is these rebates are rarely, if ever, passed on to the end payer to decrease the cost of healthcare. And that's a crime. There's a lot of other things that PBMs do that drive up the drug costs, and they're not transparent by any means, and they hide these. And they also change the name of what they call them, so that it's very hard to legislate against. They're very unfair, but it's what they do. I'll keep this real brief. I could talk about this for hours. Rebates and discounts are the big things. I think we're all pretty well aware of that. We also have some PBMs that are putting brand name drugs on their formularies and refusing to pay for the generics because there is a rebate arrangement in play that's driving up costs. My customers pay a lot of money for premiums. They have big deductibles. They have big copays. What they tell me is, I pay my premium because I have to. I never get to use my pharmacy benefit because I never make it all the way through my deductible, so why am I paying the premiums? And we see this all the time. In the last couple of years, the PBMs have changed their course with the independent and retail pharmacies. We have seen copayments go from $5 and $10 at the point of sale when we give them their medication to $100, $200 type thing, sometimes two or three times greater than what my cash price is. They're paying the pharmacy zero, but they're dictating what that patient pays at my cash register. So I applaud some of the provisions that have been passed to help get these PBMs corralled, but we still have a long ways to go, and I will help in any way I can. We do the right thing for our customers, so gag order was lifted even before the gag order was lifted. You're a good pharmacist. You can kind of lead your patient to where they need to go. So where we saw copayments coming up at $200 or $300, where my cash price was $50, you pull the person aside and say, okay, here's the deal. I'll charge you cash for it. It's going to cost you $57. You go through insurance. Yes, it's going to go towards your deductible. Yes, it's going to go, through the but you're going to pay $300 for it. That patient says, charge me cash. I'm not going to hit my out-of-pocket anyway. Go ahead and do it. What that does to the pharmacy, though, with the games that the PBMs are playing in the background, is that claim didn't go through the pharmacy PBM switch now. Means the PBM didn't see it, didn't get to gather the data, didn't get to sell the data, didn't get to do what they normally do with it. And now my patient looks non-adherent to the insurance company because I did the right thing. My performance is now nicked because my patient didn't take their drugs. So now my reimbursement goes down and I get hurt for it as well. There's a few other things that the PBMs do. One is spread pricing. What they will do is they will pay the pharmacy $10. They will charge the plan, the state, the union, the employer, whoever, $20. They keep the middle. That's not passed on. We're just starting to find some of these things out because pharmacists have never been able to get to the raw data. So we're now starting to get ourselves put on boards in right places where we can see the raw data and go back and look at what I was paid versus what they were charged. And we're starting to put this stuff together. Another practice that they do is called clawbacks. So what they will do is set a copayment of $50. and then they will take $20 away from the pharmacy on the back end. So basically, we're inflating the price to the customer, again, driving up the cost and taking it away from the pharmacy, which is just acting as the middle person. I think basically, if we can do something to take the PBMs out, and I have slides that someday I'll send to everybody, but insulin is a big thing, and we all talked about insulin. If the manufacturer makes insulin and it costs $100, the PBMs, the insurers, the TPAs are inflating that by between $200 and $250, just adding in all their expenses and things like that, passing down to the customer, and that's how these prices get inflated. It's just the nature of the practice. It's going to be difficult to figure out. It's going to be difficult to get our arms around, but we have to stop this type of thing going on because prices aren't coming down. All this profit is going to line the PBM's pockets. I mean, if you look at what healthcare has done, prices have gone up. Let's take a look at the spreadsheets and what the PBM's profit looks like the last few years. It's been nuts.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Keveny.
Keveny.
I really wish we had a lot more time to hear from you. I regret that we don't, but we really appreciate you coming here. I have a couple of questions from members. Representative Grunhagen?
Yeah, just Deb is from my district, so I hope everybody raises their opinion of me slightly. No. No, she's an encyclopedia, but you know, one of the things I just really wanted to say on a serious note is, to the degree that we can pass legislation that helps independent drugstores, because they're being eradicated, especially in the rural area, I think that's the type of legislation that would not only help in terms of access for patients and bringing the cost down, but let's keep independent druggists in business, because the momentum is to wipe out the independent druggist, and the PBMs are a big part of that from what I've learned from Deb. And I think if we all keep that in mind, we can build strong bipartisan support to pass some legislation that really makes a difference. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And the fact that you listened to her did raise my opinion of you. Thank you. So, Representative Halverson.
Thank you. And thanks, Representative Grunhagen, for those comments. My question is actually along the same line. First of all, I did want to say, you talked about insulin manufacturing at $100. I think the research is showing that it can be manufactured for $5 or less. That's kind of what we're hearing. I just wanted to be sure that was on the record, because it says a lot about the price increases. But my question is not about insulin. It's really about how your job has changed and what the trend has been with regard to your needing to be the expert on price and systems and profit, as opposed to being the expert on patient care. I have a chronic illness. My pharmacist is part of my care team, but I'm wondering how that impacts you as a pharmacist to be the interpreter, mediator with regard to the rising price of prescription drugs, and when you saw the trend change. Because I kind of think this, we're kind of boiling the toad, right? Like, it's like, how did we get here? When did this start to change?
It actually started with Medicare Part D. When Medicare Part D started, that is when the PBMs kind of started off as transactional organizations, and they kind of blossomed from there. Obamacare opened up the Affordable Care Act opened up the door to a lot more of what they could do, what they could charge for, and then opened up a lot of opportunities for them to profit from it. My day is now spent helping people try to figure out how to afford the drugs to take care of themselves. I have a gentleman that just decided he wasn't going to take insulin anymore because he couldn't do it. We had to put him on some older medications, which are working. But now, instead of taking one shot a day, he's now taking 3 or 4 tablets a day. He has to see a dietitian on a regular basis, test his blood sugars more often, but at least he can afford what is happening right now. 89% of my business, the price is dictated by a third party. I don't have control over 89% of my business. And out of that, CVS Caremark is the biggest PBM out there. That's my competitor. So this whole system has allowed my competitor to price my prescriptions. What we have found is in a lot of the raw data that pharmacists like me are now starting to get a hold of, CVS I pick on them because they're the biggest, but most of them do this, steer my patients away from my pharmacy to their own pharmacy. And what we found out with this data is they pay their pharmacies more than they pay me. So my competitor is paying me less than they pay themselves and steering my patients away from my store to their retail store, into their mail order, and into their specialty drugs pharmacy business. So not only do I have to help my patients find medications they can afford, I have to find a way to keep my patients because I have outside forces trying to pull them away. And there was supposed to be a great big firewall between the claims adjudication side and the other arms so that my competitors wouldn't know what I was charging, wouldn't know where my patients are. I've got patients that are getting letters and text messages and phone calls from the PBM-owned pharmacy saying, hey, I just saw you got your prescription filled at Kevany Drug. Did you know you can get 3 months at our mail order for less, or go to a CVS store and you can get it for zero copay? Now, how fair is that? I mean, I will never be able to buy drugs as cheap as the big guys, and that's okay. I just want a level playing field because I will kick their butt every day on service, and I'll take care of my patients better than they ever could. But right now, they're siphoning off my patients. They're lowering my reimbursement rate to the point where it's getting more and more difficult. Didn't even get to DIR fees. I paid enough in DIR fees over the last 2 years. I could have put a full-time pharmacist behind my bench filling prescriptions and taking care of our patients.
Well, thank you very much for being with us today. We're going to, before we end here, are there other members of the public that wanted to testify? Because we are 15 minutes over. We are scheduled for it to have a tour that was supposed to start pretty quick now. So were there other people in the audience who wanted to testify? Okay, I'm not seeing any. So we have a couple more questions then. Representative Baker, I don't know if this is for this current testifier.
Madam Chair, okay. It is, yes. And I want to say hi to Deb again. It's been a while. She had a store of a pharmacy in Spicer for a few years, and I got to work with her firsthand because she is the kind of pharmacist we all want in our communities. And we all have a Deb Kevany in our own towns, in our communities. So I hope that we all reach out to those people. But her passion for her patients, I've seen it firsthand when she was working with our economic development committee in town, and really appreciated that. So Deb, what you've heard today, if I can ask this, because again, the pharmacy benefit manager bill that was passed that we, most of us here supported, because we need to get this information out there. What are the top 2-3 things you want to see as a pharmacist out there that we can try to get our arms around? Because we can't do much without information. And this transparency thing is what's really important to this. So is there one or two items you want to make sure we get out of this so that, Mr. Brookwood can hear this from the Department of Commerce and those kind of things, that we make sure we get this right so that we can make better decisions going forward? But can you advise on what those one or two items might be?
I think most importantly is going to be the transparency. And that's a transparency right down to the claim level. So we paid pharmacy X, we charged the plan Y, the rebates went here, and then they've already started doing this because we're fighting against the DIR, so now they're starting to change the terms of what they call these fees and these assessments and things like that against pharmacies. So instead of a DIR, now they're calling it a GER. They're coming up with all these other things. So the transparency is going to be difficult because they're going to be able to continue to evolve, call things differently, and say, well, that's not what you guys asked us for, so we didn't have to give it to you. Probably the biggest thing I would say is to stop the steering of patients away from their chosen pharmacy. Stop the forced mail order. I've got patients, I had one that showed up yesterday in my pharmacy. Second fill at the retail pharmacy, it gets rejected and saying that after two fills at the retail pharmacy, you have to go to mail order. Okay, how long does it take to set up a mail order prescription? You don't do it in 10 minutes. Takes a couple weeks. That person standing in front of my counter with no medication, being told that they can't get it filled there because they have to go to a mail order pharmacy. So now they're paying cash for it until the mail order. It's just wrong. It's just wrong. So if we can stop steering patients away, and I'm just saying, level the playing field for independent pharmacies. They're killing us on reimbursement rates, and then they will send us faxes asking us if we want to sell our pharmacy to them. It's ridiculous.
Okay, so thank you. Don't leave. I think we've got more questions, so just to let people know. So I've got Representative New, Representative Mann, Representative Hamilton. We are 20 minutes past our adjournment time. So, and I don't know if people wanted to go on that Mayo Clinic tour. So can we, if we could just be real brief, and then let's just end with Representative Hamilton, because I think we, as much as I'd like to go on into the evening, I don't think that we're going to be able to do that here. So Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just really quickly, I think that we had some really important presentations, and I certainly appreciate Ms. Kevney and her testimony. Was this hearing recorded? Will it be on the House website for the rest of the public to be able to view?
Yeah, it is being recorded. So absolutely. We weren't able to do a live stream, mm-hmm. but it is being recorded.
And it'll be available on the House website later?
Yes.
Okay, wonderful. And then my next question, I very much appreciate you willing to be able to add to the agenda revisiting the PBM issue with the Commerce Department later on. I'm hoping, Madam Chair, that we can also get a commitment to add to the agenda a hearing on DHS. We've yet to see a hearing on DHS and be able to question what is happening with the chaos there.
Well, Representative New, we hear from DHS all the time on our committees, and we will continue to do that. We hear from them continuously throughout the session, and so that is definitely going to be something we will continue to do. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Ms. Kevney. So some of the issues that you have raised is exactly why we passed this PBM bill in the first place, and you summarized it very, very nicely. And I just wanted to touch upon those things very briefly. We absolutely deal with the transparency of the rebates. Where are they going? Where they come from? How much are they? All of that information. The clawbacks, the spread pricing, we're going to get all that information. And I'm really excited to do that. And then the transparency piece, we fought really, really hard to get as much data as humanly possible in this bill. So I'm glad that you said that, because it's, to me, it's also the most important part of the bill. And then with the overall goal of exactly leveling the playing field and working and seeing, those poaching techniques and trying to put a barrier between directing patients to PBM-owned pharmacies and the price they pay to those pharmacies being different than the price they pay to other pharmacies. So thank you for bringing those up, and I want you to rest assured that that's exactly what we're working on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The only last thing I would say is...
We've got one more question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Do you want to comment first, and then I'll go to the last question, please?
Yeah. They're not fiduciarily responsible for anything right now. They don't have to take care of the patient. They don't have to take care of the plan. If you make them responsible, they'll probably act a little differently.
Thank you. And Representative Hamilton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in essence of time, I'll just say thank you so much. You're spot on. And you have supporters here that we're trying to do the best that we possibly can. It's no secret. My colleagues are telling me to breathe over here because I despise pharmacy benefits managers and the damage that they have caused to me personally as well, not to mention everybody else across the state. And I think they have completely lost their way, and it's nothing but legalized theft currently. That's my statement. Nobody else's. That's mine. And so thank you for your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Hamilton. Thank you so much for coming to testify. We really appreciate it. I want to be sure we catch your contact information, and certainly this is a longer conversation, and you bring a very important perspective that we don't always get to hear. So thank you so much for taking the time. With that, members, I really, let's give her a hand. We don't usually do that in committee, but we are today. So I want to thank the University of Minnesota Rochester for hosting us today and giving us this wonderful facility to use, and Mayo Clinic for their work with us and the tour that many of us went on earlier. And if there's still time, there was supposed to be another Mayo Clinic tour that's kind of a general tour. If anyone cares to do that, I'm not exactly sure what gets covered, but Kate Johansson is here in the back raising her hand, and we can gather around her and find out what she's able to do with us in the short time that we still have. So thank you, members. We are adjourned.